Chapter 3. Business. Curse him. The boat was very close now.
Oh, yeah. Man. Hail Delmayer.
The sound of voices ceased, but the paddles worked as furiously as before.
Then the bush in front of Elmayer shook, and the sharp sound of the paddles falling into the canoe rang in the quiet night.
They were holding onto the bush now, but Elmayer could hardly make out an indistinct dark shape of a man's head and shoulders above the bank.
You Abdullah? Said Elmayer, doubtfully.
A grave voice answered, "To an Elmayer is speaking to a friend. There is no Arab here."
Almayer's heart gave a great leap.
"Dane," he exclaimed.
At last, I have been waiting for you every day and every night. I had nearly given you up.
Nothing could have stopped me from coming back here," said the other, almost violently.
"Not even death," he whispered to himself.
"This is a friend's talk, and is very good," said Almayer, heartily.
"But you are too far here. Drop down to the jetty, and let your men cook their rice in my campong, while we talk in the house."
There was no answer to that invitation.
"What is it?" asked Elmayer, uneasily. "Here is nothing wrong with the brig, I hope?"
"The brig is where no Orang Blanda can lay his hands on her," said Dane, with a gloomy tone in his voice, which Elmayer, in his elation, failed to notice.
"Right," he said. "But where are all your men?
There are only two with you."
"Listen, to an Elmayer," said Dane.
"O Moro's son shall see me in your house, and then we will talk. Now I must go to the Raja."
"To the Raja? Why? What do you want with Lakamba?"
Tomorrow we talk like friends. I must see Lakamba tonight."
"Dane, you are not going to abandon me now, when all is ready?" asked Elmayer, in a pleading voice.
"Have I not returned?
But I must see Lakamba first for your good and mine."
The shadowy head disappeared abruptly. The bush, released from the grasp of the bowman, sprung back with a swish, scattering a shower of muddy water over Elmayer as he bent forward, trying to see.
In a little while the canoe shot into the streak of light that streamed on the river from the big fire on the opposite shore, disclosing the outline of two men bending to their work, and a third figure in the stern flourishing the steering paddle, his head covered with an enormous round hat, like a fantastically exaggerated mushroom.
Elmayer watched the canoe till it passed out of the line of light. Shortly after, the murmur of many voices reached him across the water. He could see the torches being snatched out of the burning pile, and rendering visible for a moment the gate in the stockade round which they crowded. Then they went in apparently. The torches disappeared, and the scattered fire sent out only a dim and fitful glare. Elmayer stepped homewards with long strides and mind uneasy. Surely Dane was not thinking of playing him false. It was absurd. Dane and Lakamba were both too much interested in the success of his scheme. Trusting to Malays was poor work, but then even Malays have some sense, and understand their own interest. All would be well must be well. At this point in his meditation he found himself at the foot of the steps leading to the veranda of his home. From the low point of land, where he stood, he could see both branches of the river. The main branch of the Pantai was lost in complete darkness, for the fire at the Raja's had gone out altogether, but up the Sambar reach his eye could follow the long line of Malay houses crowding the bank, with here and there a dim light twinkling through bamboo walls, or a smoky torch burning on the platforms built out over the river. Further away, where the island ended in a low cliff, rose a dark mass of buildings towering above the Malay structures. Founded solidly on a firm ground with plenty of space, starred by many lights burning strong and white, with a suggestion of paraffin and lamp glasses, stood the house and the godowns of Abdullah bin Salim, the great trader of Sambar. To Elmayer the sight was very distasteful, and he shook his fist towards the buildings, that in their evident prosperity looked to him cold and insolent, and contemptuous of his own fallen fortunes. He mounted the steps of his house slowly. In the middle of the veranda there was a round table.
On it a paraffin lamp without a globe shed a hard glare on the three inner sides. The fourth side was open, and faced the river. Between the rough supports of the high-pitched roof hung torn rattan screens. There was no ceiling, and the harsh brilliance of the lamp was toned above into a soft half-light that lost itself in the obscurity amongst the rafters. The front wall was cut in two by the doorway of a central passage closed by a red curtain. The women's room opened into that passage, which led to the back courtyard, and to the cooking shed. In one of the side walls there was a doorway. Half-obliterated words, Fice, Lingard and Company, were still legible on the moldy door, which looked as if it had not been opened for a very long time. Close to the other side wall stood a bent wood rocking chair, and by the table, and about the veranda four wooden armchairs straggled forlornly, as if ashamed of their shabby surroundings. A heap of common mats lay in one corner, with an old hammock slung diagonally above. In the other corner, his head wrapped in a piece of red calico, huddled into a shapeless heap, slept a Malay, one of Almayer's domestic slaves, "why own people," he used to call them. A numerous and representative assembly of moths were holding high revels round the lamp to the spirited music of swarming mosquitoes. Under the palm leaf thatch lizards raced on the beams calling softly. A monkey, chained to one of the veranda supports retired for the night under the eaves peered and grinned at Almayer, as it swung to one of the bamboo roof sticks, and caused a shower of dust and bits of dried leaves, to settle on the shabby table. The floor was uneven, with many withered plants and dried earth scattered about. A general air of squalid neglect pervaded the place. Great red stains on the floor and walls testified to frequent and indiscriminate betel nut chewing. The light breeze from the river swayed gently the tattered blinds, sending from the woods opposite a faint and sickly perfume, as of decaying flowers. Under Almayer's heavy tread the boards of the veranda creaked loudly. The sleeper in the corner moved uneasily, muttering indistinct words. There was a slight rustle behind the curtain doorway, and a soft voice asked in Malay, "Is it you, father?" "Yes, Nina. I am hungry. Is everybody asleep in this house?" Almayer spoke jovially, and dropped with a contented sigh into the armchair nearest to the table. Nina Almayer came through the curtain doorway followed by an old Malay woman, who busied herself in setting upon the table a plateful of rice and fish, a jar of water, and a bottle half full of genever. After carefully placing before her master a cracked glass tumbler and a tin spoon, she went away noiselessly. Nina stood by the table, one hand lightly resting on its edge, the other hanging listlessly by her side. Her face turned towards the outer darkness, through which her dreamy eyes seemed to see some entrancing picture, wore a look of impatient expectancy. She was tall for a half-caste, with the correct profile of the father, modified and strengthened by the squareness of the lower part of the face inherited from her maternal ancestors, the Sulu pirates. Her firm mouth, with the lips slightly parted and disclosing a gleam of white teeth, put a vague suggestion of ferocity into the impatient expression of her features. And yet her dark and perfect eyes had all the tender softness of expression common to Malay women, but with a gleam of superior intelligence. They looked gravely, wide open and steady, as if facing something invisible to all other eyes, while she stood there all in white, straight, flexible, graceful, unconscious of herself. Her low but broad forehead crowned with a shining mass of long black hair that fell in heavy tresses over her shoulders, and made her pale olive complexion look paler still by the contrast of its coal black hue. Almayer attacked his rice greedily, but after a few mouthfuls he paused, spoon in hand, and looked at his daughter curiously. "Did you hear a boat pass about half an hour ago, Nina?" he asked. The girl gave him a quick glance, and moving away from the light stood with her back to the table. "No," she said, slowly. "There was a boat. At last. Dane himself, and he went on to Lakamba. I know it, for he told me so. I spoke to him, but he would not come here tonight. Will come tomorrow," he said. He swallowed another spoonful, then said, I am almost happy tonight, Nina. I can see the end of a long road, and it leads us away from this miserable swamp. We shall soon get away from here, I and you, my dear little girl. And then, he rose from the table, and stood looking fixedly before him, as if contemplating some enchanting vision. And then, he went on, we shall be happy, you and one. Live rich and respected far from here, and forget this life, and all this struggle, and all this misery. He approached his daughter, and passed his hand caressingly over her hair. It is bad to have to trust a Malay, he said, but I must own that this Dane is a perfect gentleman, he repeated. Did you ask him to come here, father? Inquired Nina, not looking at him. Well, of course. We shall start on the day after tomorrow, said Elmer, joyously. He must not lose any time. Are you glad, little girl? She was nearly as tall as himself, but he liked to recall the time when she was little, and they were all in all to each other. I am glad, she said, very low. Of course, said Elmer, vivaciously, you cannot imagine what is before you. I myself have not been to Europe, but I have heard my mother talk so often, that I seem to know all about it. We shall live a glorious life. You shall see. Again he stood silent by his daughter's side looking at that enchanting vision. After a while he shook his clenched hand towards the sleeping settlement. Ah, my friend Abdullah, he cried, we shall see who will have the best of it after all these years. He looked up the river and remarked calmly, another thunderstorm. Well, no thunder will keep me awake tonight, I know. Good night, little girl, he whispered, tenderly kissing her cheek. You do not seem to be very happy tonight, but tomorrow you will show a brighter face. Eh? Nina had listened to her father with her face unmoved, with her half-closed eyes still gazing into the night now made more intense by a heavy thunder cloud that had crept down from the hills blotting out the stars, merging sky, forest, and river into one mass of almost palpable blackness. The faint breeze had died out, but the distant rumble of thunder and pale flashes of lightning gave warning of the approaching storm. With a sigh the girl turned towards the table. Almayer was in his hammock now, already half asleep. Take the lamp, Nina, he muttered, drowsily. His place is full of mosquitoes. Go to sleep, daughter. But Nina put the lamp out, and turned back again towards the balustrade of the veranda, standing with her arm round the wooden support and looking eagerly towards the Pantai reach. And motionless there in the oppressive calm of the tropical night she could see at each flash of lightning the forest lining both banks up the river, bending before the furious blast of the coming tempest, the upper reach of the river whipped into white foam by the wind, and the black clouds torn into fantastic shapes trailing low over the swaying trees. Round her all was as yet stillness and peace, but she could hear far off the roar of the wind, the hiss of heavy rain, the wash of the waves on the tormented river. It came nearer and nearer, with loud thunder claps and long flashes of vivid lightning, followed by short periods of appalling blackness. When the storm reached the low point dividing the river, the house shook in the wind, and the rain pattered loudly on the palm leaf roof. The thunder spoke in one prolonged roll, and the incessant lightning disclosed a turmoil of leaping waters, driving logs, and the big trees bending before a brutal and merciless force. Undisturbed by the nightly event of the rainy monsoon, the father slept quietly, oblivious alike of his hopes, his misfortunes, his friends, and his enemies, and the daughter stood motionless, at each flash of lightning eagerly scanning the broad river with a steady and anxious gaze. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.